Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. As coal layoffs continue and jobs become more scarce in parts of Appalachia, some families are turning to education as a means to a better future, like coal miner's daughter, Savannah Lusk.
That's what he would tell me. He'd say, it doesn't really matter, but just get out of here and do something big with your life. Because I know he wished he could have done that. He wasn't able to do that.
We'll also hear from parents of first-generation college students.
When you're a heavy equipment operator for 24, 25 years, you know, there's not a whole lot of use besides being an equipment operator. So I just keep plugging along.
But coal miners are not all backwards and stupid. And coal camp girls are not all backwards and stupid. So
you'll find these stories and more this week Inside Appalachia. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. Being a first-generation college student isn't easy. It's tough to leave home and be a trailblazer. A lot of these students have a lot of pressure to help support their family once they graduate. As the coal industry continues to decline, some families are looking to education as a key to the future. On today's show, we're going to hear from two of those trailblazers who are up against the odds. You see, first-generation or low-income students are less likely than their classmates to graduate from college. Each student faces different challenges, but some reasons are common. Some students struggle with finances. Many still need to work, and job responsibilities can take away from academics. First-generation low-income students can be unprepared academically and may not have college knowledge that other students have. They may not know who to turn to for help on campus, and finally, life or family issues can create challenges for students with this background. In West Virginia, about 49% of students across both the public 2- and 4-year system had parents with a high school education or less. That's far above the national average of 33%. About 40% of the students attending a small school in southern West Virginia are first in their family to attend school. As the director of retention, it's Sarah Beasley's job to help students to graduate from Concord University.
Low-income and first-generation students are less likely, not only less likely to attend college, but less likely to graduate, and they have lower confidence in their abilities to actually attain a degree. So I think it's important that we have the discussion in higher ed in West Virginia.
Going to college was always this mystical thing that I knew I was going to do. I took college prep courses in high school, but still wasn't exactly sure how to get there. I applied to Concord University and got in. I was a cheerleader, so I don't think the transition was terrible for me socially. But I did miss opportunities with financial aid because I didn't know about FAFSA deadlines. And sometimes I felt like I was behind my classmates. A professor once told me that I couldn't help that I was educated in southern West Virginia. My family was always encouraging, but really, they just had faith in me to get it done. My father was especially proud of me. I had a unique experience. My freshman year was especially tough because my father was killed during a workplace accident. I ended up taking some time off after failing some classes and partying too much. Then I inherited a workers' compensation monthly check if I went back to school. So I did. And this time around, I was determined to finish to honor him. And when I walked across that stage, my cap read, "For you, Daddy." Some of the challenges for first-generation college students can't really be calculated with stats or numbers. When you have little money, just the slightest challenge can set you back and keep you from class. Today on Inside Appalachia, we're going to hear from first-generation college students from here in Appalachia. We're going to hear from two students whose parents have been struggling to support their families since the coal industry began to decline. In September, we heard from an underground coal miner from southern West Virginia. William Lusk and his family already suffered through a layoff last year when he was unemployed for about 3 months. He works at a mine owned by Patriot Coal and was recently put on notice that he could lose his job. But it looks like a deal with Black Hawk Mining means he'll get to keep working, for now. And he doesn't see much future in the job he's been doing for 23 years.
I don't know if it would ever get any better. What they need to concentrate on is You know, if they want to do away with the company, just bring some other industry in here for us to do. I mean, I'll be 45. And if they had a Toyota plant close by or something, I mean, I don't expect to make miners' wages.
But one expense William doesn't have to worry about so far is the college education of one of his daughters. Savannah Lusk was awarded the Foundation Scholarship, a full ride to WVU. It goes to only 5 students with top grades and test scores. Among other things, students taking the ACT must score at least a 30, a score achieved by only 5% of students across the country. This past summer, I visited Savannah and her family at their home in Coville. I'm familiar with this part of Wyoming County. You see, I grew up just a few miles from Coville in another coal camp town called Itman. Savannah gave me directions to her family home, and it sounded a lot like the way to get to my childhood home. It basically read, "Come off the mountain, go past the church, and to your right there's a little holler. Turn there and follow the road all the way down to the end of the paved road, and it'll be on your right up a gravel driveway." Just inside the front door hangs a chandelier made of antlers. There's a tree decorated with deer antlers in the corner of the clean and tidy home. Most of the racks are from William's days as a hunter. Savannah's mom is such a fan of the camouflage that the print is sprinkled throughout the house.
And then you picked out a couch too?
Yes.
She's a camo.
I'm the camo. I got a camo Hummer too. So I'm the camo.
It's in the garage. See where all my coal mining money went.
Exactly.
Savannah has lived here all her life.
I love it, personally. Like, I went to Herndon Middle School, and there's probably about, 20 kids in my 8th grade graduating class. So, definitely very personal. And, but I always knew, my parents always instilled in me that I couldn't be, you know, I couldn't just limit myself to here, that I needed to branch out. And I think it gave me a good foundation. And it also gave me something to hope for.
Savannah's father, William Lusk, remembers his daughter as a tomboy, but not a daddy's girl.
Daddy wasn't here enough for her to be daddy's girl. I was always at work. I wanted to be here. But I would have to say mom was their biggest, because her mom was a stay-at-home mom. And when we decided to have children, we made that choice.
Savannah says her mom insisted on the very best in her from school.
You see, parents all the time doting over their children. Oh, they're so great. And I never got it doted over. That never happened to me. I'd come home with a 97 and mom would be like, "Well, where's the other 3%? everything I would do, my mom would, she'd be like, "Good job, but how can we do better?"
As an assignment for high school, Savannah was to search potential scholarships for college. At the time, she had no desire to attend a school with the reputation of burning couches and partying. But the ease of navigating WVU's site made it a little more attractive, and she found the Foundation Scholarship, a 4-year full ride to the Morgantown campus.
I saw that scholarship, and one of my friends came up behind me, and I said, "Look, there's a full ride to WVU, and it says only 5 people get it. 5's not a lot." And he was like, "Kids like us don't get that." And I was like, "What do you mean?" It's like those big schools up there, like G-Dub and stuff. Up in Charleston area, Wheeling, they get that. We really don't stand a chance. And I was like, that pissed me off, quite frankly. I was like, well, what makes them any better than me? And I started thinking about me growing up here, what made me any different than people that grew up, their parents, doctors, or whatever. How could, my background like that make me any less of a student, make me any less of a person? So right then and there, when he said that, that was my challenge. So as I told you, I didn't apply to any other schools because I had tunnel vision.
So you proved him wrong.
I tried, yeah, and I did succeed. I like to prove people wrong.
Do you feel pressure?
I do feel pressure sometimes, but I love it. I love the fact that not that the spotlight's on me, that I have an opportunity to really make something of myself and to just show kids back home that they can do whatever they want. Doesn't matter where they're from. And I actually love the pressure because it gives me that do or die attitude. So there's absolutely no room for failure. And even if I fail a little bit, there's a little bit that I just pick myself up and then succeed at the next thing, you know.
Neither of Savannah's parents went to college. Her dad says there was no need to because a coal miner could make a good living.
Some people who live here, especially in the coal industry, the one thing is the money that they make. Mm-hmm. I make more money than about all my aunts, and most of them are either nurses or school teachers. And the school teacher, I triple, almost quadruple make what they make, mm-hmm. which is not right, but it's the truth.
But things are different now. Since March of 2012, almost 11,000 coal miners have lost their jobs in West Virginia alone. Of those, more than 4,000 coal miners weren't able to find work. Even when the money was good, William didn't want his kids to follow in his footsteps, doing heavy physical work and worrying about booms and busts. He always encouraged his kids to go to college.
That's what he would tell me. He'd say, it doesn't really matter, but just get out of here and do something big with your life. Because I know he wished he could have done that. He wasn't able to do that.
I wanted her to be able to, you know, to have that, to have a thing to where maybe where she would have been a step up from where her parents was at, where she could have been able to excel in something, you know. All I ever done was just make a living. You know, I don't know if I really had a career. It's just, you know. But, you know, or make a difference, you know, make a difference. Maybe you can make a difference in something. I don't figure I ever made much of a difference as far as to society.
What you were talking about, always wanting better for your children. You know, one thing that rings very clear, and I was telling Savannah this, my daddy used to always tell me, Jessica, get an education, go to college, so you don't have to work like a dog like me. And that's exactly how we put it.
Yeah, you really you don't. If you could just work with your head a little more than your back, and those jobs are now getting further and farther between.
And William is proud he has a daughter who can work with her head, a daughter who defies stereotypes.
Everybody's not backwards or inbred or whatever they want to say, you know. We live in homes, we have indoor toilets and everything. So
imagine that.
Yeah, imagine that. And another thing they don't realize too, but coal miners are not all backwards and stupid. And coal camp girls are not all backwards and stupid. So.
And his daughter Savannah Lusk is proving that to be true. This is Savannah's sophomore year at West Virginia University. She says she still hasn't made a B, but rather all A's.
So are the classes hard at WVU, you think? Have they been challenging?
Well, yeah. I mean, definitely a little bit more than I expected. My hardest class was anatomy. It was difficult, but I managed to pull an A in it somehow by the grace of God. They definitely bring a whole dynamic to the table, because in high school you're just memorizing facts, and then in college you have to think critically and you have to perform all these labs. So it's definitely different, a whole other dimension.
Have you met a lot of different people up there from different places?
Oh, yes. That's my favorite part, because here you really don't get diversity. There's, like, a class of all white people, Christians mostly. My best friend, he's Muslim. You know, I have Indian friends that come from different cultures. I've learned about Hinduism. Just so many things. People that have been different places around the world that come from mixed backgrounds. It's amazing. It's changed my life, really. Like, I never knew about culture and about diversity until I went there. Like, I've taught them a lot about, like, Christians, people that believe in God, as opposed to, you know, the Christians that they see on television, you know, that are sometimes demonized and stuff like that. So they have misconceptions, and I have misconceptions about, you know, Hinduism is and Islam that I've actually cleared up too. So it's great to see the other side of the fence, really.
So far, Savannah Lusk, the coal camp girl from Coville, is thriving. She's even picking up new hobbies.
I picked up guitar, and then I picked up kayaking in like a 3-week span. And Mom's like, you've been starting so many hobbies, you're never going to get into them. I said, Mom, I'm going to be jamming on my guitar and my kayak, and you're going to be jealous.
I guess I've kept you in. And
you yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can't kayak in Coville.
So do you have any hobbies?
Mowing grass.
Eating ho-hos. Mowing grass. I used to really love deer hunting and stuff like that, but
the way the mining industry is being, that you work 6 months, you're off, and you lose all your vacations, so then you start again. I love to hunt, but it's one of those things you got to have time.
William climbs up the stairs to get some sleep before going to work the night shift underground while Savannah pulls out a guitar, her new hobby.
Okay, so I bought it from a flea market for $80. And I've just always wanted to play it. I love singing. Mom knows I love singing. Like at like 5:30 in the morning when I get ready for school, I would be just belting out songs and Mom would be screaming at me.
She pulls up a video on YouTube.
This is how I learn. I basically... See, that's like how I learn. Like I just watch videos and I try to play. Like... Can't. It's so nerve-wracking. That's like the intro to You Are My Sunshine Set.
Things are going well for Savannah during her sophomore year, but it's not all sunshine. We checked in recently to see how things are going. She's still making A's, but she's also noticing that a lot of her peers' parents are college graduates and can help them navigate the university life. While others just have extra funds, she said, it's a little bit intimidating to meet folks whose parents are doctors, but she's pushing through. She even helped to create a student organization to bring lunch to cancer patients in the hospital. She hopes to eventually be a cancer doctor. She says she wanted to move away from Wyoming County at first, but now she's considering setting up a practice in her hometown. She hopes her earnings will help to lift the financial burden from her family.
It's really stressful for them. I actually went through a period of time that I did not want to go home to my family. As sad it was enough because I could escape up there, I could pretend that it wasn't happening, but when I came here, I could see it on everybody's faces and see the stress and the worry, and I really didn't want to deal with it. So there was actually a point in time that I didn't come home for a while. But then I realized that I was actually going to go on a trip on spring break, but then I realized that I shouldn't run away from it. My family needs me. And sometimes you just got to help them pick up the pieces and work towards just doing the best you can. It's hard. Miners do make a lot of money. I mean, I'm not hurting for anything, but it's so inconsistent. And the beating, the psychological beating that my dad takes, not only physical, is very, it's, you can see it in his face all the time. And it's upsetting. And it only makes me want to work even harder to try to get him away from that. Maybe eventually one day.
You're a pretty incredible girl, you know that.
Thank you. You're pretty incredible yourself.
Yeah. Pretty incredible for overcoming the challenges. And Savannah's not alone in struggling to juggle family relationships and school. Director of Retention at Concord University, Sarah Beasley, says it's common for students who are the first to go to college in their family to feel this way.
They often will talk about having to navigate sort of two different worlds, their college life and then when they're home, that experience that they sometimes feel like they really can't share their college experiences because their family members have not had those and might not completely understand what they're going through, and vice versa. When they're on the college campus, maybe they feel like their friends who aren't first generation really don't understand what it's like to be from a family whose parents haven't attended college.
Beasley says another challenge for first-generation students is the feeling of isolation.
I'm certainly not trying to generalize, but just some of the research shows that first-generation students and low-income students as well sometimes get to college and really feel like they don't belong there. So there's a lot of research that talks about this sense of belonging and ways to make first-generation students and others really feel like they belong on a college campus. So building that self-confidence that students can be successful.
Sometimes first-generation students lack the self-confidence to apply for a top college. It's called undermatching. They could get in, but they don't realize it, so they don't even apply. But some first-generation students do shoot for the stars, like this guy.
This here is my baby. This is my 12-string Taylor acoustic guitar that my loving, perfect, wonderful sister bought for me for my graduation.
Logan Bays proudly displays his guitar as he walks down the hallway of his family's tidy mobile home in the mountains of Nicholas County, West Virginia. He pulls up a chair in the living room to demonstrate his guitar skills. He's been playing for about 7 years.
I know a lot of people love the song Dock of the Bay by Otis Redding, I think. So...
Logan's dad, Lincoln, listens from the kitchen. Lincoln's home today, but recently he's been spending days or weeks in Ohio or northern West Virginia to find work. He spent more than 20 years working as a surface coal miner to support his family. Lincoln remembers a time when he took his kids to the work site.
And it was a hot day, so we drove down and watched them put a shot off at a safe distance and everything. And then we stopped and played in the creek for probably 2 hours. And her mom was really glad to come home when they was mud from head to toe, but they had fun. So, but tried to show them what I'd done.
I remember going on his job, and I remember watching them, you know, they had all the explosives laid out and blew off the top layer of rock. And I remember seeing just these huge boulders the size of trucks flying through the air, like, I don't know, like I would throw gravel or something.
Things are different now. Logan's dad, Lincoln, is struggling to find work in state. As a coal miner's son, Logan's familiar with the boom and bust cycles, but like so many folks say, somehow this time it just seems different.
Towards the last few years, when my father was employed in the coal industry, it started off with decreases in time. He used to work Saturdays voluntarily for overtime, but then they started doing the Saturday work on a rotating basis. And soon enough, they cut out working any overtime. When overtime was gone, you know, we could still deal with it. You know, we had to pay attention to what was going on, you know, make sure that nothing popped up. But it wasn't, you know, the end of the world. But then they started cutting, hours and benefits. The benefits was the last straw, but they started cutting hours first. It went from working 5 days a week, 14 hours, to working 4 days a week. It was stressful. There's no sugarcoating. It's when your family's income is cut by, you know, a third to half, it's not exactly the simplest thing.
How do you feel hearing your son talk about this and the struggles and knowing how hard you've worked before? And
it's tough. Just is.
Lincoln's eyes fill with tears. He says one of the toughest parts is the loss of camaraderie that came with being a coal miner.
You get used to the men and working with them. It's just like a family. So... I spent a lot more time with them than I did at home most of the time. But you have to go to work, so pay the bills. When you're a heavy equipment operator for 24, 25 years, you know, there's not a whole lot of use besides being an equipment operator. So I just keep plugging along.
And like William Lusk, Savannah's dad, who we heard from earlier in the show, Lincoln also encourages his son to get an education.
He came to me one time and told me he wanted to be a mechanic, and I told him that, no, that's not the road that you're going to travel. Yeah. You're going to go to school.
Yeah. That's just because I want to take apart things, though. So that changed real quick. I figured out that, you know, you can do that and get paid for it. It's called being an engineer.
And why did you encourage him to go to school instead of that?
Just so he'll have a future, you know. mechanic, and there's nothing wrong with, but it's just not the path that I wanted for him.
Yeah. I think
it'd be hard.
Oh yeah. I mean, you can't go mechanic at one place for, you know, you can't retire from it. You can't start here and retire. You know, you're going to have to get this job, and then you'll lose it, and you'll get another job. And just, you know.
I think that was it. 12 years old or something, though. My dad was like, no, that's not stable. That's not stable. Right. You want something. He doesn't want just the job, you know. He wants me to have a career.
Yeah.
Definitely.
A future.
Neither of Logan's parents went to college, but academics were always a priority in the house.
My dad always says, do as I say, not as I do. And he wants me to aspire, in his own words, to go to greater heights than what he did. He doesn't want us to have the same sort of struggles involved with being with the mines or having a job with no degree or anything. He wants us to have a skill that we love and that's marketable, and that, you know, beyond that, he wants us to lead a life that to the best of our abilities and not accept mediocrity, and to be the best that we can be, and just sort of, you know, try to avoid some of the things, some of the struggles that, you know, he's had to deal with his job and stuff like that, and that we've had to deal with.
Logan really took this idea to heart and decided to reach for a goal that most of his classmates don't even attempt. He had the ambition to shoot for the most prestigious school in the country. He applied to Harvard.
When I told people, I was like, yeah, I'm applying to Harvard. You know, they'd snicker and they'd be like, oh, really? Well, tell me how that goes. So, and that sort of aggravated me because I was doing it as a joke. I wasn't going to be the joke, you know? So I decided, I was like, well, you know what? I will show you.
Last year, more than 37,000 people applied to Harvard, but only 1,900 potential students were accepted. That's 5.3%, the lowest acceptance rate in the history of Harvard University. Harvard admissions representatives tell us the university only accepts somewhere between 2 and 7 West Virginians per year. One of those students was, yep, you guessed it, Logan Bays. His dad gets emotional talking about how he reacted to the news.
I was very proud of him. To get accepted to Harvard, that's a big accomplishment. But very proud of him.
Logan was excited to hear he was accepted to such a prestigious school. But when he visited Cambridge, he kind of felt out of place.
I remember sitting in Annenberg Hall, which is the dining hall, and sitting at this large oak table. There's the largest collection of non-secular stained glass in the world sitting around, marble busts, and then these immaculate paintings. They're sitting at this table here and eating our food, that, you know, and I remember it was like all this stuff around me, and I try to start a conversation with the people at the table. The people that I do remember, there's one guy I remember sitting at that particular event. His name was Jad. He was from Lebanon, right? I would try to start a conversation, and they would go around the table, 16 people at a table. They'd all say their piece and then go right back to eating their food. The only one who would have a conversation with me was Jad. And I found that very descriptive of the type of people that I met while I was there.
Logan says it just didn't feel like the place for him, and he started thinking about other options, like WVU. Logan had attended a WVU recruiting session in Beckley, West Virginia, in which the president, Dr. Gordon Gee, encouraged all the potential students to send him a direct message if they had any questions. So Logan sent an email to Gee. He told Gee about his dilemma, and Gee suggested Logan should visit Morgantown. Morgantown doesn't exactly have the reputation that Harvard has. In fact, it has a reputation of a party school. The Princeton Review has ranked WVU in the top 6 party schools for the past 5 years. Still, when Logan visited Morgantown, he found that it felt more like home.
It's a sense of community, definitely. And it's a big thing in West Virginia, is that sense of community. You know, that's what makes us so special, in my opinion, from anywhere else. And I told him how I felt like, I didn't feel that soul at Harvard, as old as it was, you know, and all the stuff it had. I felt more soul at West Virginia University. They had just this magic, just this, you know, the camaraderie, the prestige in themselves. Just they wanted each other to do as good as they could, you know, do as well as they could, and achieve great things and go first and all that.
So Logan made his decision to stay in West Virginia and attend WVU. Logan says it was also the unique, quirky style of the Mountain State that kept him here.
I don't know if I will stay here for, you know, my entire life. I would like to, you know, move to a beach somewhere for a little bit, but I do see myself coming back to West Virginia, definitely. It is a very special state, and it's got a very special place in my heart, and it's different from anywhere else that I've ever been. It's sort of, you know, another analogy is that West Virginia is like the Shire. Everybody's kind of cranky little hobbits, but, you know, I love it here. It's special. It's special. Everybody's nice. The place is beautiful. It's got that muggy, humid heat that you got to get over. But, I mean, what else is there? Where else could you ever want to go? I mean.
So Logan wasn't going to Harvard after all, and now he had to tell his dad. His dad, Lincoln, was so proud that Logan was accepted to Harvard. So I was surprised when he told me how he felt when Logan told him he didn't want to go to Harvard after all.
I was relieved.
Oh, yeah?
Very. It's 12 hours to get to Harvard. It's very expensive to live up there.
Harvard comes with a price tag of about $60,000 a year, and that's not counting an estimated $3,000 for books. Harvard boasts that students with families who make less than $65,000 annually don't have to pay tuition. But the financial aid packet Logan filled out reflected his father's income as a coal miner from the previous year. So Logan didn't qualify for this low-income program, even though his father's income when he applied was nowhere near what he made as a coal miner before. Logan says Harvard offered him a scholarship, but it didn't cover all the expenses. West Virginia University offered him a full ride. So Logan says going to Harvard would have been too big of a burden on his family. But he doesn't blame his parents. He says he's grateful for the advice they've always given him. Lincoln looks at his son, Logan, as they sit at the table. Lincoln's eyes fill with tears as Logan explains it was the influence of his parents that helped him believe in himself. The first step in at least trying great things.
You know, don't ever listen to the negative talk. And if you don't believe in yourself and someone's trying to tell you, like my parents tried to tell me, do your best. Listen to them. You can do whatever you set your mind to. And that is not some sort of cliche that Disney came up with to sell more movies. You can do what you put your mind to.
As for his dad, Lincoln is proud of Logan for getting the scholarship to WVU. He looks across the table at his son and says, you done real good. Logan says it's going well in Morgantown, and he doesn't regret his decision. He still plans to become a plastic surgeon and specialize in reconstructive facial procedures. He says he wants to help trauma victims so they don't have to live with the constant reminders of their injury. Still to come, we'll hear what folks at Harvard had to say about Logan's decision and find out what they're doing to try and make first-generation folks feel more welcome. This is Inside Appalachia. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On today's show, we heard from two first-generation college students whose fathers are coal miners, or, well, used to be coal miners. We heard from Logan Bays, who decided not to attend Harvard because he just felt out of place there, and it was too expensive. So we wanted to reach out to Harvard's admissions counselors to find out what they thought of Logan's decision. In the last few years, there's been a big push to award grants to all students whose parents make less than $65,000 a year. Harvard's admissions counselors are hoping this will help encourage more first-generation students like Logan Bays to apply. Bill Fitzsimmons is a dean of admissions at Harvard. Roxy Todd called him up to chat.
Bill, you're a first-generation college student yourself, so you know there are challenges that first-generation college students face. Can you talk about some of those challenges, and what do you think can help students cope, especially students attending an Ivy League school like Harvard?
Well, I think the first thing to do is just to state right up front that first-generation students are succeeding at every level at Harvard. The thing that is of concern and really quite alarming is that if you're a student from the lower income categories, you're six times less likely to complete college than if you had come from the top part of the economic income distribution. My family ran a gas station and a mom-and-pop store, and even though I grew up within 20 miles of Harvard, I had never seen Harvard until my senior year in high school. There are some challenges in the sense that, you perhaps haven't had family members who have been through this kind of thing before. I know I relied very heavily on my advisors, and I also, because I came to know my financial aid officer well, I also relied on him. In just in the past 10 or 11 years since we put together a new revolutionary financial aid program, we've had about a 33% increase in the number of students from modest economic backgrounds. For families under $65,000 a year income, it's free for those families. And we're somewhere in the 13-14% range now for first-generation students, and because all these figures have been going up in recent years because of the financial aid.
When first-generation college students say they decide to enroll and they've been accepted into Harvard and they come in, one of the challenges for some people, it sounds like, can be socializing and fitting in, feeling that the rest of the population at Harvard, they can get along with them and make really good friends and connections, which is a big part of the college experience. What are people at Harvard doing to help low-income or first-generation students really feel like they can fit in?
Best? Well, they do fit in. As they say, they're graduating at the 97-98% rate that everybody else graduates, and we typically would have among the highest or the highest graduation rates in the country. So this is a great success story. Freshmen come in, and they don't have one single advisor. In some respects, they actually have three advisors. Now, the way we work it today, we literally run out of our admissions and financial aid office. We run the first-generation student group, and these are first-generation students who want to make sure that they help us in recruiting, but they also want to make sure that first-generation students here are comfortable and successful. Last 2 years, I've spoken at a graduation week. The first-generation student organization gets together, and they have a special gathering for parents and students of the graduates who were first-generation. And it's really a celebration of the fact that first-generation students are here in much larger numbers today, and the fact that you want to celebrate your background and the fact that you were able to do so well. And I think not in spite of the fact you were first-generation, I think often because you were first-generation, because you had a set of experiences that some other people at Harvard didn't have. So there's a lot of first-generation pride here, as it turns out.
And speaking of that, we just heard the story of Logan Bays, a coal miner's son from West Virginia who was accepted into Harvard but decided to stay here in West Virginia. So why does Harvard want to see more talented students like Logan Bays enroll in Harvard?
I just think one of the best things about going to college is the education you get from your fellow undergraduates. This is in the rooming groups and the dining halls and small classes and extracurricular activities. If you often look back at your college experience, you'd say, gee, one of the best things, I had a wonderful education from my professors and they were great resources, but learning from your fellow classmates is just a critical part of college. And I think he would have added enormously to our student body, and we tried our best. He ended up staying closer to home, and I think he just felt in some ways that University of West Virginia would be a better match for him. But we're going to keep trying. I mean, you know, we know how good he would have been here, and we know how good he will be at the University of West Virginia. But we know there are lots of great people like him, you know, throughout the area. So we're going to keep on trying.
Well, thank you, Bill, so much for talking with me.
Well, it's great to talk to you, and I hope very much that we're able to get more of those great kids from West Virginia and from Appalachia. They will add immeasurably to Harvard or to any university they attend. So thank you very much, Roxy.
Oh, thank you.
That's Bill Fitzsimmons, a dean of admissions at Harvard University. Oh, and when he said the University of West Virginia, of course he was referring to West Virginia University. Bill Fitzsimmons was speaking with our producer, Roxy Todd, about Harvard's plan to welcome more low-income or first-generation college students. To learn more, you can head to our website. That's wvpublic.org. While a college degree doesn't guarantee a job, it does help. And there are even some studies that show that people with college degrees live longer. According to a study in the scientific journal PLOS ONE, people who receive a higher education outlive those who don't. According to the study, failing to obtain a higher education could be as detrimental to a person's life as smoking cigarettes. Still, research does not show that there's a direct link between a college degree and overall sense of well-being. A 2010 study by the Center for Health and Well-Being at Princeton University, for example, found that all other factors being equal, college graduates report more stress than non-graduates. In West Virginia, almost a third of jobs don't require a high school diploma. But you're still more likely to find a job if you have one. A recent report by the State West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy found that the state has the lowest workforce participation rate in the country, meaning a lot of adults don't have jobs. The report says that's partly because West Virginia's population is older, is in relatively poor health, and has completed less formal education. People with a college education are more likely to be working or looking for work. That's true across the country, but having a degree in West Virginia helps even more than other states. So far, Logan and Savannah are doing well at their college of choice. But getting past the freshman year is part of the challenge. First-generation college students are four times more likely to drop out of college, and students from a low-income background are six times more likely to drop out than students with wealthy parents. Concord's Sarah Beasley says even the mindset for first-generation students can be a challenge.
First-generation students sometimes have very high educational aspirations, but their expectations or their belief that they can actually earn that degree tend to be lower than peers whose parents did attend college.
So just believing in yourself, as cheesy as it sounds, can be helpful. We've also posted a few other tips for first-generation college students on our website at wvpublic.org. Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry. Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and wvpublic.org. You can subscribe and listen on your own time. We always love hearing from our listeners, and some of our shows lately have gotten quite a response. We wanted to take a moment to read a letter we received last week from one of our listeners. Joshua Weisberg wrote, "Greetings from across the border in Pocahontas, Virginia. I love listening to your program on West Virginia Public Radio, especially when you discuss farming opportunities, environmental issue, and the rapidly growing local food movement. Would you be able to provide any information on where to get started as a felon getting out of prison and desiring to become a local food organic farmer? On a recent Inside Appalachia show, you spoke of coal miners possibly turning to farming, and I'm curious if you know of any organizations that might help a felon transition into farming, or any related organization that may be able to help, or at least point me in the right direction. Sincerely, Joshua." Joshua, thank you for your letter. We sent your question on to a few people who are working to help farmers in Appalachia, and we also reached out to the Extension agent in Tazewell County, Virginia. We'll be sending you some more information in the mail soon that might help you get started. But we also wanted to read your letter on the air in case any of our listeners have any idea. So if you know of a program that might help Joshua find resources he needs to start out as an organic farmer, please send us a message on Twitter at InAppalachia or write us at 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. Hey, we love receiving letters. Thanks, Joshua, for reaching out. And thanks to all of you who have sent us letters recently. Now, today we're going to round out the show with our What's in a Name segment, where we explore the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. There's a park in Appalachia with a name that's hard to pronounce, but what's even more interesting about it is that a lot of people think it's the site of the Battle of the Revolutionary War. What park has a marker commemorating that battle? We'll have the answer in just a minute. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. History teaches that the Revolutionary War began in Concord, Massachusetts in April of 1775. But is that right? Or did the first battle of the Revolutionary War happen in Appalachia? On this week's What's in a Name, we visit the scene of a battle that happened in October of 1774 in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. Laura Allen brings us the story.
First, there's how you say it.
It's Tuindy Park, right? Oh, yeah.
To something.
You know, I can't say this.
Two rivers something. To something. Tuindy. Tuindy.
Tuindy State Park is in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. It's just a couple of blocks from downtown, nestled between the Ohio and Kanawha Rivers. Park Ranger Doug Wyant translates the name this way.
The point between two rivers, according to the Wyandot Indians.
Each year, the park hosts battle days to commemorate the Battle of Point Pleasant. Reenactors are dressed in colonial-era tri-cornered hats and blue dress uniforms. They're showing kids how to fire a musket in one corner of the park. Native Americans are drumming and leading dances in another. Part of their job is to teach school kids and visitors about the battle. And there's more than one version of history to teach.
What happened here?
My impression, while I was here a couple weeks ago, I found out by reading things it was the first battle of the Revolutionary War, where
Loretta Viskers from Quaker City, Ohio.
George Washington came, and actually that's how Point Pleasant was named, because he came and said, wasn't this a pleasant point?
Loretta's got some of the story right. It's true. George Washington surveyed the area, though he never fought here. In fact, historians don't think the battle that happened here had anything to do with the Revolutionary War. But don't tell that to Darlene Hare.
I'm a member of the DAR, and I very strongly believe that this is the first battle of the American Revolution.
Tuindy State Park was the scene of the Battle of Point Pleasant. That fact's not in dispute. A colonial militia was trying to push the Shawnee people away from settlements along the Ohio River. But the Native Americans weren't giving up their hunting grounds without a fight. Park Ranger Doug Wyant.
It was October 10th, 1774. It was a Sunday, and the soldiers had awoken to some screams of the hunters that had been sent out that morning to hunt for animals to eat for breakfast, rabbits, whatever they could find. And they came upon the Shawnee who were advancing from the north toward their camp. And one of the hunters got away and actually got back to the camp and alerted the camp that the natives were coming, and they rushed out to meet them, and they fought where the actual city of Point Pleasant is today.
Fire!
The one thing that you have to remember is that the Shawnee were fighting for their homeland. And the battle did go back and forth. It was an all-day battle. At times the Shawnee had the upper hand. At times the colonials had the upper hand.
The colonials eventually prevailed. And there were lots of fights between settlers and Native Americans in those days. So why do some people think this was a Revolutionary War battle? Well, somehow a rumor got started.
Supposedly, the British were actually backing the Shawnee at the time with weaponry and food and propaganda, and saying that if you'll do this for us, this is what we'll do for you. So that's how we actually say that, you know, it was, if not the first battle of the Revolution, it was one of the first battles, because the British were actually against the colonials at the time.
It turns out this rumor goes all the way back to the 1780s, when Colonel John Stewart, who led a colonial regiment in the battle, wrote a memoir. In it, he accused the British of aiding the Shawnee. He believed they were trying to weaken the Colonials in preparation for the battle for American independence. And remember the DAR? That's Daughters of the American Revolution. 150 years later, they used the memoir to make a case for the whole Revolutionary War thing. Dave Cannon is standing around a campfire with a few of his fellow reenactors. In between sips of coffee from a pewter mug, he shares that story.
There was a lady named Puffenberger. She wanted to join the DAR, and she could not prove a direct link to somebody in her family that fought in the Revolution, but she had a direct link to somebody that fought at Point Pleasant. So the story I heard is she went to her congressman and gave him a nice little political contribution, and this guy tacked on pork. The Congress voted for a bill to build a dam or a bridge or something. And, oh, by the way, let's make Point Pleasant the first battle of the American Revolution.
Was this a Revolutionary War battle or not?
No.
The Virginians were being led by Crown officers. They were paid by the Crown. They were fed by the Crown. They were fighting for the Crown. The Indians were fighting to preserve their own property. So it had absolutely nothing to do with the American Revolution. The only connection there is a lot of Virginians got combat experience that they used during the Revolution.
Revolutionary War battle or not. In 1909, a stone monument was built that still stands in the center of the park. It honors the men who died in the first battle of the American Revolution. So what does Ranger Doug Wyant tell visitors to the park? Did the Revolutionary War start here?
History is interpretive, you know. That's what I try to tell everybody. And it just depends on who's telling the story, what you believe.
It's kind of like saying, to when do we? It all depends on who you ask. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Laura Allen at To When Do We State Park.
Fire!
Move!
If you have another story about to when do or to when do we, to when do we, to when do, or how did she say? What did she say? To when do we, St. Park, Street Park, or know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at In Appalachia, hashtag what's in a name, and we might explore it inside Appalachia. Well, that's our show that talks a little about first-generation or low-income college students. I hope you found it as inspirational as I did. Cheers to the trailblazers who persevere and never give up. But like coal miner William Lusk said, even the jobs for those with college educations are scarce in rural regions like southern West Virginia. I hope that West Virginians will continue to pursue an education, despite the fact that they may have to leave their home to find work in a field of their dreams. And when you get to college, pay close attention to the actual job opportunities that could keep you home. Could your hometown use an accountant, a chemist, a nurse? Music in today's show was provided by Mountain Stage, Ben Townsend, Jake Sheps, and Andrea Tomasi. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our audio mixing is by Scotty White. Our editor is Catherine Winter. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
He built the home I live in, sand and mud and smoke, sand and mud and smoke. Yes, we will leave here without a trace. Take a new name and an old shape. I'll be no outlaw. Go just your faithful God of laws. Mm-hmm. spider does its work with flakes of garlic and petals from a rose. If it's small enough to care, you and I can call it home. You and I.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.